Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I want to get to last night. What an amazing night that was in sports. An unbelievable Tuesday night. Philly eliminates Brooklyn. The Golden Knights and the Sharks did what they did. In fact, what an amazing game that was. Vegas goes into the third period with a 3-0 lead in Game 7 on the road, only to see San Jose score four straight to take the lead. Then Vegas scores with less than a minute left in regulation to tie it, to force OT in a Game 7. Are you kidding me about that? So for a while last night, that was going to lead this show. That's how good that game was. It was going to take the first spot of the show away from Philly, stomping Brooklyn, and Oklahoma City winning in Portland to keep their season alive. Because despite Damian Lillard going for 34 in the first half, the Thunder had that lead in the second half. It looked like they were going to take that series back to OKC. And then this tweet from the Blazer Twitter account. Quote, Nurk is here. Nurk is here in all caps. He was watching the game at home and said that he left his house to come to the arena with 3 minutes left in the third quarter. Quote, I knew it was going to make a difference. End quote. Now, if you think that I'm taking my time in setting this up, you're damn right I am. Because you've probably already seen what happened. And if you haven't seen what happened, of course, that's on you. But what happened is even more impressive when you understand the buildup to what happened. Because sure enough, Nurk rolls in and Portland goes on a run. But before we get to that run, about a moment for Nurk's fashion. He not only came to Game 5, he came to Game 5 at the last moment wearing a shirt which read, Got Bricks? Next question. What an amazing troll job that is. Rocking a t-shirt, clowning Russell Westbrook. The crowd responds to his arrival. His teammates respond to his arrival. And after being down 15 with less than 8 minutes to go, and 8 with less than 4 minutes to go, the Blazers battle back. They tied it on this from Damian Lillard.
Lillard going for a quick 2-for-1. All the way to the hoop. He put it up and in! 32.7 seconds left. Tied again at 115.
Russell Westbrook goes down. He misses on a drive of his own. And then came this. Damian. Lamont. Ollie. Lillard Sr. with the ball. Time is running down. He's got Paul George, one of the best defenders in the league, on him. So what do? Do you try to drive past him, draw contact, get into the paint, try to get it off the backboard? Nope. You dribble. You stay roughly a mile from the basket. And at the very last second, you let it fly. Here's the call.
Tied again at 115. Lillard out front against George. 5 seconds. George backing up. Lillard doesn't want to pick. Dame going for the win. A three-pointer for the game.
Yes! Trail Blazers Radio Network. All right, I'll admit it. When he let that go, my reaction was, what the hell was that? And then when it went down, my reaction was, what the hell was that? And I'll tell you what the hell that was. One of the most ridiculous game winners you're ever going to see in any sport, ever, anytime. 50 burger, game winner, mic drop, walk off. Don't even change expression. Have yourself a night, Dame. And the best part of that shot, the shot that they'll be talking about for decades to come in the PDX. The best part of that shot may not have even been the shot itself. Because as cold-blooded as that shot was, the shot was not the best part. The best part was the reaction and the wave. My man ran a stake right through the heart of Russ, PG, the Monster Kid, and all of OKC proper. Then he pulled it out of their chest and he let them bleed out. And then, and only then, did he wave goodbye. He just buried a shot from about 1,000 feet away to end that series, to get to 50, and he waved at the Thunder as they lay there dying.
5 years ago, Lillard hit a three, a
against your Rockets.
Yes.
To win a first round series. Damian Lillard for 50 points. Good night, Oklahoma City. Season over.
That's a superstar series from Dame, but that was a legendary moment. That wave was iconic. MJ used to have the greatest game-winning reaction ever when he went with that leaping air punch over poor Craig Elo. But this tops that, because this was cold as hell. It had professional journos cursing on Twitter in awe. It had LeBron James tweeting a watch emoji. I've said it before, I'll say it again right now. Dame time is all the damn time. And if that wave was not ironic enough, how about him looking up at the camera when he's being mobbed by his teammates who are losing their bleep? And he had this absolutely blank look on his face. My man is an absolute killer, a stone cold assassin. He makes Jay Wright and Tony Bennett look like complete spazzes in pressure situations. The shot, the wave, the stare. And then did you catch Dame in the post-game interview on the court?
I mean, in the NBA, teams go on runs. And before you make your breakthrough, adversity is going to hit. We knew it. You know, we had been shooting the ball well. Things started going our way. I knew eventually we was going to have to fight through something to come out big. And our team fought through. You know, we made shots, but what we was able to do on the defensive end, we came up with big stops. Mo hit two big free throws. We made every play we needed to make to win this game. Team effort.
Dame. My man sounded like he was talking about a Wednesday night game in January. Not a closeout game. In a deeply personal series where he hit 50 from 50 to end it. And then, when he had some time for it all to sink in, he was still very matter-of-fact about it, right? That shot. Oh, the shot. Oh, you mean that shot? Yeah, that was no thing at all. That was no thing at all. Just the thing that I prepared for and I expected.
So I was standing there looking at the rim, and I was like, this is a comfortable range. My trainer, Phil Beckner, we was working out the other night in OKC, and he was just like, just take a few deep ones, you know, off the dribble. Let's shoot a few deep ones. And he was like, I'm telling you, you're going to hit one of these. He just kept saying, you're going to hit one of these. And when I was standing there, I was like, I'm going to shoot it. You know, he was a little bit off of me, and I was like, it's enough space for me to just raise up and shoot it for game. And at the last second, he stepped towards me a little bit, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to pound, dribble, sidestep, and raise up, you know. And I just had to let it fly, you know, shoot the ball high in the air to give it a chance, and that's what I did.
My man is absolutely cold-blooded. Pound dribble, sidestep, raise up. Pound dribble, let me change that. Pound dribble, sidestep, raise up. Reach into their collective chest, rip their heart out, show it to them, eat it, and then wave. Oh, and about that wave.
It looked like after you hit that shot, you waved to the Oklahoma City bench. Could you just describe that moment and just kind of the emotion, what you were thinking at that point?
I mean, the series was over. You know, that was it. And I was just waving goodbye to him. And I think after game three, you know, Dennis Schroeder was out there pointing to his wrist. They was out there doing all these celebrations and doing all this stuff, and we kept our composure. And after one win, that was what they decided to do. And we was just like, okay, what we want to do is win four games. And then when we win those four games, it's not going to be nothing to talk about. So that's what that was.
Damn, my man's cool. Find me a guy cooler than Dame right now. That was a statement, too. His whole series was a statement. If you've not been paying attention, again, that's on you. Because a superstar was not born in that series. A superstar was born in practice gyms when he was working on that shot with Phil Beckner. You just noticed him now. And if you just noticed him now, you're really late. In fact, too late. A legendary shot, a legendary wave, a legendary reaction. And I will say it again now so all of you can hear me. Dame time is all the damn time. Yo, Rip City, today is your day. You've been waiting a long, long time for today. I'm talking to everybody tucked away and forgotten in the Northwest. You always say that you don't get your shine. Come and get some. I'm talking to everybody listening on 750 The Game in the PDX. Your dude just pulled up from the Burnside Bridge and buried OKC. As you all know, it takes more than hard work to make it to the pros. It takes smarts that can read a defense and pick it apart. Hiring now is no different. You need smarts to find the right people, but you don't need to spend years honing your game. You simply need ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and then invites them to apply to your job. Try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ziprecruiter.com/clones. ZipRecruiter.com/CLONES. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Let's keep it in Portland. Adam, you're next. Hey, Adam, how are you?
Oh, man, I am so pumped on this team. This is so nuts. This whole series has been crazy. It's playing out like it's like a movie or something, man. Like the whole, like, Portland's like a bunch of, like, good guys who are, like, humble. OKC has all mouths. And they were just, like, you know, trash talking. And then Dame just shut them down. And he's all about, like, stone cold glare after he's done. He's not throwing his hands up in the air. He's just taking care of business. Like, honestly, if we go to the finals this year, they're going to make a movie about this team in this season. Because, like, they counted us out at the beginning. They said we were done when Nurk went down. And Dame just put the team on his back. I mean, the other guys are doing it, too. Like, he influences them. He's, like, the best leader. I'm just so pumped right now.
Such a good call, Adam. Rack him. And by the way, my call screen right now is Portland, 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 Portland. David in Portland. David, how are you?
I'm good, Jim. Thanks for having me, man. And let me just tell you something right now. Last night, it wasn't just about Dame. It was about Rip City, okay, and the passionate fan base that resides here, okay? The nation got a whiff. They got a whiff, Jimmy. They got a whiff of what being a Portland fan looks like. They say Boston's a sports town. They've never seen what we have in Portland until now. And while, and you know what? And while I'm at it, Jim, let me just give you a little message, you know, a little PDX message to the NBA free agents out there. Hey, Kwai. Hey, AD. Wake up and consider bringing your talents to Portland. You've now seen and you know what we're about. Come to the city, who will immediately begin plans for your jersey retirement and wax sculpture once you sign that paper. Come to the city where people actually hold the door open for you. Come to the city where people give you an aggressive apology if they cut you off at the grocery store. Come to the city where who gives $9 million contracts to Myers Leonard. I'm getting pissed off, Jim. I got to go. I'm out.
Nice job. All right, let's go to the phones. We go to Portland. Lance, you are first up. Hey, Lance, how are you?
What's up, Rolly? First, shout out to you, you and your show. You guys are awesome. But check this out. I don't mean to steal your thunder. Oh, check that pun. I got three things to tell you, though. Right off the bat, we've known about Dame Dalla for years now. You know what I mean? Nobody else sees this, but we do all day long. This guy's got ice water in his veins. Oh, shout out to CJ, too, because he's badass. And then number two, okay, this team, everybody thought when Nurk went down that we were just going to fold and collapse, you know what I mean? No, this team's gelling. This team gelled. Enos Kanter, shout out to you. Rodney Hood, I mean.
No. You don't like that. Bro, like that. I know you're fired up. I know it's a big day. I'm not talking you off that point. No four-letter bombs on the show. I know it was not intentional. We go to OKC. Derek, it's good to have you on the show. Derek, how are you?
I'm doing real good, Jim. I listen to what you say, and I think there's a whole lot of truth. Listen, fans around here, they do not like to hear what they have to hear today. They got to hear it from all the national media. They don't want to hear it. They don't like it. However, I will say this. These fans around here, they have been with him for a long time. They have loved him for a long time.
Who,
they
Russ?
Love who he is and how he is. They love that demonstrative style. They love the competitiveness. They love the effort that he gives. He's a pit bull. Fans love that kind of stuff. He's a compelling figure and all that. And then when KD leaves and he decides to stay, he shows his loyalty and he stays. Well, they really love that. And then he goes out, wins the MVP. It's all great. But I will say this, and I think it's hard to say, but I think it's just the truth. Around here in this city, as great as these fans are, as much as they love him, they are starting to question all of these antics. They are questioning the antics on the court, because when you play it up like that, and when you really show all that emotion, and when you talk all that trash, and when you do all that, but you cannot back it up. And no matter what you say, all those triple-doubles are fantastic, but this is still a simple game. It just comes down to shot-making. I mean, it's very simple. You just have to be able to shoot, unless you're Shaq. or something like that. But he don't play at the basket, so he has to shoot. But then also this crap with the media. It is wearing thin. He's not a young kid anymore. He's a veteran, and he's supposed to be the leader of this team. And I think he's got to go in the offseason and soul search a little bit. And I think what they're going to expect is that he is going to grow up a little bit, and he's going to get his emotions in check, and he's got to start practicing his shot. That's all I got to say.
That's a really good call, Derek. Really good call. I agree with almost all of that. My guest is Jordan Palmer. Jordan, really nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm out here in Nashville, and it's been a blast and kind of a weird year. Nobody really knows what's going to happen, so it's been fun.
I like it. I like it a lot. All right, let me start first with the fact that you are in Nashville, and I've had a number of draft prospects on the show trying to build up to the draft, and every one of these guys, Jordan, talks about the process and what it's going to be like when they get their name called. So what's the draft evaluation process like for you, and what are these last few hours like? For instance, are you nervous for your guys, or are you pretty relaxed?
No, I'm relaxed. I mean, regardless, this is like a dream come true. I just don't see too many bad scenarios. You know, these guys are, you know, for Drew Locke, who's here because he's, you know, going to be a first round pick, and for the other two guys that are at home, and for all the guys that are going through it, I mean, you have to play at the level that you dreamed about playing at. You're about to get paid to do it. I always tell guys, because right now it's really easy to get nerve wracked right now. And it's like, listen, as soon as you put that hat on, like, now you're just a chief or a bill or a jet. You know what I mean? It just all changes once you put that hat on. And so there's a lot of nervous energy building up to it. There's a lot of scenarios playing out. I look at it and I tell guys, we talk a lot about, and when I'm training guys, the neutral thinking, just that it's grounded in fact. Let's just look at the facts. Don't get too high. Don't get too low. Stay neutral. I think the last week or two of the draft, leading up to the draft, I challenge them. I say, hey, this is a rep at getting good at neutral thinking, because you could waste a lot of time thinking about a million different scenarios, or you can just work out each day and focus on what's in front of you. And so it ends up being a good rep for these guys. And the guys that embrace that, they end up just enjoying the process and stoked to be here.
Jordan Palmer joining us. All right, so if you and I go back a little bit, you've said in the past that when you were growing up, when you would do what your brother Carson would do, it did not look the same, and that you could actually teach it maybe a little bit better than you could actually do it. Can you lay that out for me? What did you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, I could always explain things better than I could do them when it came to football, and unfortunately, Carson can do them better than he can explain them, and he's got a lot more money than me. But but honestly, it's also tied more to the gift and like my purpose. And so for me, you know, communication and is a strong suit of mine, but also the way that I played the game. I was the guy that it was just always asking the defensive coordinators questions. I was always picking other quarterbacks' brains on how they prepare and how do they watch tape. I was just always fascinated by the development of quarterbacks, even while I was playing. And when I was playing, I was doing it to benefit myself, but I was also doing it to benefit the guys that I knew I would work with inevitably down the road. And so, you know, it's pretty cool. I mean, Carson and I are similar in a lot of ways and complete opposites in a lot of ways. And I have this amazing relationship. I just got back from Easter with them. But the role that I play in these young guys' lives right now is a similar role that Carson played to me, where Carson for sure was my big brother, but when we played together, when I was in college and I was playing on other teams in the league, he was the older vet. And I think if you lined up 100 quarterbacks who played a long time and you said, who'd you learn the most ball from? They would have most of them would probably reference an older player before they would reference a coach. And so I'm not a guru or a whisperer. I'm just the older vet in the room that's trying to help them become a better pro.
Jordan Palmer joining us. He's a quarterback consultant now and a former NFL quarterback. You know, Jordan, I'm trying to get to your guys, but I think your backstory is so interesting. As an example, when you were a backup quarterback in Chicago, you spoke at the rookie symposium. What do you remember about that, and what was it about that experience that made you decide, I want to tutor somebody in draft prep?
Yeah, you know, I was speaking about something, you know, unrelated to draft training at the symposium, and I don't even remember who the guys were really, but I just remember asking these rookie guys. And so you figure this was in July, so they just got done with their first offseason, but the season hadn't started yet. And just kind of, you know, catching up, hey, man, how was offseason? How was OTAs? How was training camp and all that? And I just remember the things that they were telling me was really hard. I didn't think should be hard. It was very simple schemes, memorization, concepts, formation. It was very simple things. So I just started asking them, like, so what'd you do January? What'd you do February? Like, what have you been doing leading up? And they all talked about how they got stronger and faster and they lost body weight or body fat and all this just irrelevant stuff. And I was like, man, I'm going to train somebody next year. And I was in the market for free training. and so I did a deal at a place, Exos. They do a fantastic job. And I said, look, I'll train whoever comes through the door. Let me train here for free. And the first guy through the door was Blake Bortles. And at the time, I hadn't really heard of him because when you're playing in NFL, you don't watch college football because you're busy on Saturdays. And the last thing I want to do is watch another game. And so I didn't really know who the UCF kid was and all that. And, I said, look, he came in and interviewed with me. We kind of met each other that day. And I was like, look, I don't know a ton about the combine and all that stuff, but I'll get you ready to play. I'll teach you all the stuff you probably should know going into your rookie year. And then the way that ended with him being the third pick and, you know, all the excitement and fun, it was intoxicating for me. So that was the first year I did it and have now built a really cool thing where now it's really a community where my previous guys, so last year it was Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Kyle Allen, they actually helped me in draft training this year in exchange for me training them. You know, they're there in doing the board work, helping with protections, helping with the interview process that they just went through a year ago, which has created an environment where, and I call it QB Summit because it really is just a gathering of young leaders where guys like Drew Lock and Jarrett Stidham and Tyree Jackson, now they're getting literally the best information from the best peer group available, and it's just become a really cool little community.
Jordan Palmer joining us. All right, so let me ask you about Jackson. You told Bleacher Report that Jackson's, quote, size, arm talent, and instincts put him on a trajectory that I haven't seen since Patrick Mahomes was a sophomore at Texas Tech, end quote. Obviously, that's incredibly high praise, quite a comparison. What have you seen from him that makes you say that?
So it's less about me saying I think Tyree is going to be the MVP in 2 years. That's not what I'm saying. I wouldn't say that about anybody. What it is when I met, so Cliff Kingsbury called me years ago and said, hey, I got this kid, he's super unique. And so I had one of my QB Summit camps where I bring the college guys in as counselors, and Pat was one of the guys, him and Deshaun and Sam and a bunch of these guys. And the thing that I saw with Patrick was that he was raw and his feet were all over the place, and yet the ball did the same thing every time. It went exactly where he was going. He was incredibly accurate despite the lack of consistency in his mechanics. And Jim, I don't know if you golf, but I'm not a very good golfer, so I swing a little different every time and the ball goes a little different direction every time.
Hey, Jordan, that's why I don't play golf, by the way. That's the exact reason I do not play golf.
Totally. And so, but if I swung it different every single time, but it always went where I was aiming, then I don't really have a whole lot to work on. Right. Sure. And as an amateur now with Tyree, it was the same thing. When I first met him last July, which, by the way, was the first time he'd ever been on the field with a private quarterback coach. He was 20 years old. And I have 9-year-olds at my camps, right? Wow. Like 20 years old, the first time he got on the field with a private coach.
Amazing.
And it was a little raw. It was a lot of the things I was saying with him were new. And yet, he was really consistently accurate, had a giant arm, and was really twitchy and explosive. That's what I saw in Patrick. That's what I see in Tyree. And I would say that Patrick has gotten a lot better, but Patrick isn't even where he's going to be in a couple years, which is really scary. And Tyree, I see the similar thing. Really inconsistent mechanics growing up, and yet really consistently accurate. And so as he continues to develop his mechanics and all the new stuff becomes, you know, comfortable and normal, I'm really excited. I look at that and I go, 6'7", 250, ran a 4.59, can do any dunk you want, and he works really hard and cares a lot. Like, I don't think there's a ceiling on that.
We're talking to Jordan Palmer. He is a QB consultant, a former NFL quarterback. Jordan, I'm trying to pick my spots. There's so many different ways we could go with this. We're running out of time, but I want to ask you about Deshaun Watson. You've worked with him, and there's no denying his physical attributes. But when you decide to work with him, how much of that decision was based on his physical gifts, and how much was that based on his toughness and his mental strength?
You know what's funny is I would actually kind of counter the physical gifts thing. And this is not a knock. This is a compliment on Deshaun. Yeah, I think Deshaun's, when we were going through the draft process and I was talking to teams and they always asked me, like, who's this player's comp? You know, physical comp, mental comp, all that. Deshaun's physical comp is Alex Smith. They're the same size,
wow,
same speed. Nobody looks at Alex Smith and goes, what a freak, right? So Deshaun has a really good arm, doesn't have a crazy arm. He's really fast, but he's not Lamar Jackson fast, right? It's within his chest and between his ears. And that is, Deshaun is a one in a whatever giant number you want to make up in terms of how he ticks, how he competes, how he deals with adversity, how he makes really intelligent decisions really quickly. And then the part that nobody gets to see that I got a chance to see as much as anybody is Deshaun, to the date of all the guys I've worked with, probably has the best study habits and skills and routine that I've ever been around. Like, when he takes notes, it's color-coordinated pens. If you tell him something and he writes it down, I will guarantee you he knows it tomorrow because he won't go to sleep until he does. So Deshaun, between his ears and in his chest, has very different things than I've ever seen anywhere. But physically, I mean, somebody said, you know, says names like these big, huge, giant, fast quarterbacks. And it's like, no, Deshaun's Alex Smith. But between his ears and in his chest, Dabo Swinney's right. He's Michael Jordan.
Jordan Palmer joining us. All right, Jordan, before I let you go, you're working with Drew Locke. What made him stand out to you in college, and what have you worked on with him during this process?
I just think the first thing you see with Drew, and I hope you get a chance to connect with him in person someday and test my opinion on this, he has a presence about him. And so then I look at, okay, why is that, right? And with Drew, he has been the man since he was little. Right, he was the one of the top recruits in the country, but he also was a big time basketball player. He scored 1,900 points in high school basketball. He had big offers. He's also a handsome dude who can talk and he's got some swag to him. So he's just been the coolest guy in the room, I think, his whole life. When that is your foundation, and can back it up obviously with his play, but when that's your foundation, typical things, adversity that affects other people, it just doesn't affect guys like that. And then from a physical standpoint, what he can actually do and how he plays the game is, he's a very fluid but twitchy athlete. I think his physical comp, and I don't know about, like, his arm may get there. It's not there right now, but is Aaron Rodgers. I think he's going to move and create time and space like Aaron. He's a similar body size as well. You know, Aaron doesn't rip off 60-yard runs, but he creates a ton of space and time back there. Drew will be a similar player to that. Drew has an enormous arm, too. But I think the thing that I love about Drew is just he's really smooth and fluid, but he's very twitchy and explosive. And that's a hard thing to train and develop in a guy. That you kind of got to have that. And so that's the biggest – it's his presence, his confidence, and then just how he backs it up as a player. And nothing really rattles that guy.
2019 NFL Draft gets underway tomorrow. He is a former NFL quarterback. He is a quarterback consultant. And again, has worked with guys like Deshaun Watson, Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Drew Locke, Tyree Jackson, Jared Stidham, Jordan Palmer, my guest. My man, I am kicking myself for not doing this sooner. Let's make sure we do it again really soon, Jordan. That was great. I really appreciate it.
Jim, I'm a big fan, man. Anytime.
As a pro at keeping you clones in line, at interviewing the right people in sports, here is some simple advice that can now help you. When you're looking for pro tips on vehicle maintenance or repair, look no further than O'Reilly Auto Parts. When it comes to replacing your battery, getting advice on proper car maintenance, or even just getting the best bang for your buck, their expert team can help you every step of the way. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. All right, so on the other side of that game last night, how about the Oklahoma City Thunder? More specifically, how about Russell Westbrook? Because that series did not go well for Russ in any way, shape, or form. It was not a good look on the court for Russ. It was an even worse series for him off the court. Now again, it'd be very easy to come in here and hot take it, fly in, and bash Russ. But let's establish a couple of things first. Number one, it's pretty clear that as bad a take as that was from Paul George about that being a bad shot, George is hurt. George is injured. The shoulder is more jacked up than he's letting on. I think that's pretty clear. It's also clear that the Thunder roster is not well designed for Russ or today's game. It's a lot more jacked up than anybody's letting on, like Paul George's shoulder. But let me tell you something else, which is pretty clear. Russ got outplayed. Now, actually, he didn't just get outplayed. Russ was dominated. Now, if you want to pull out an old, tired phrase from the closet and dust it off, Damian Lillard drank his milkshake repeatedly. Put another way, when it mattered most, Damian Lillard was just flat out better than Russell Westbrook. And there's no debate about that. It wasn't even close. Check out how they handled the final minute of that game. Dame with the drive to the basket to tie it.
Lillard going for a quick 2-for-1. All the way to the hoop. He put it up and in! 32.7 seconds left. Tied again at 115.
Then you have Russ. Russ going Russ with a reckless, flailing drive to the basket that resulted in nothing.
Westbrook. Takes off Amina Westbrook. No. And it's Amina with the rebound.
Then you have Dame doing this.
Tied again at 115. Lillard now up front against George. 5 seconds. George backing up. Lillard doesn't want to pick. Dame going for the win. A three-pointer for the game.
Yeah! Dame doing that, and then Dame waving goodbye afterwards. Remember, Oklahoma City swept the Blazers during the regular season, then got curb stomped by them in the playoffs in 5 games. And again, a Portland team playing without Nurk. They're playing without a player who means so much to them. They got an emotional lift just from him showing up in the arena last night. OKC was up by 15 with less than 8 minutes left. Up by 8 with less than 4 minutes left. And then they melted down, completely imploded. They scored 2 points in the final 4 minutes, and during that stretch, Russ missed 2 shots, and he committed 2 fouls. And that's pretty much how the entire series went. When they needed Russ to do something, he couldn't. In fact, there were long stretches where I forgot that he was even on the floor. When have you ever said that about a superstar? When Portland needed Damian Lillard to do something, he did. Every single time, including the final time. And you know what? Yes, I'm going to play that shot again.
Tied again at 115. Lillard now up front against George. 5 seconds. George backing up. Lillard doesn't want to pick. Dame going for the win. A three-pointer for the game.
Yeah! And you know why I played that again? I played it again because of Paul George's reaction after the game.
Bad shot. Care what anybody says. That's a bad shot. But, hey, he made it. That story won't be told that it was a bad shot. We live with that.
All right, so once again, let's get into that really quickly. I'm not going to crush a guy for what he says after his entire season has just ended. Guy's devastated. I get that. Piling on guys for things that they say after a gutting loss is kind of like shooting fish in a barrel. It's way too easy. And a lot of that should be allowed to slide given the emotion of the moment, unless it's just so egregious. Paul George just had a dagger hammered right through his chest. He had a front row seat to one of the most insane shots ever. He's been through worse, but that truly was a low point. And it ended a bitter series in the worst way, and he is human. I get him not exactly wanting to tip his cap to a rival, and I do see him working. A few years ago, in the pre-Curry, pre-Lillard era, that was a bad shot. In fact, that was a really bad shot a few years ago. Normally, if you're playing defense in that situation, you're happy if your opponent wants to take a shot from nearly 40 feet out. I mean, Paul George did his job. Normally, that might be a bad shot, but not with Damian Lillard. And George knows that, because that wasn't some desperation heave. He didn't drop the ball to his waist and chuck it like some lucky fan trying to win a car. He took that like a normal jumper. No, check that. He took that like a normal step back. Bad shot. That was a great shot. Paul George didn't force Damian Lillard into that. Damian Lillard chose to do that. There's a reason why logo Lillard is an actual term. You know my favorite part about that take is? My favorite part of Paul George saying that's a bad shot. Bad, you know, shot. What's amazingly rich? Imagine thinking that somebody else took a bad shot when you're sitting right next to Mr. Bad Shot, Russ Westbrook. Him saying somebody else took a bad shot is really rich. You want bad shots. Check these numbers. 8 for 17. 5 for 20. 11 for 22. 5 for 21. 11 for 31. Those are Westbrook shooting numbers over the course of that series. And yes, I know he's a volume shooter, and the shooting percentage is not always a great way to measure him. But that's kind of like what he used to do with Kevin Durant. And that was always thought to be one of the reasons that KD left. So now, if you're Paul George, you've got to be wondering, exactly what did I sign up for? To watch a guy take 31 shots in an elimination game and make a third of them. And speaking of KD, Russ has not won a playoff series or even a road playoff game since KD left. I know Russ has been dealing with an injury all year. I know it's impacted his shot, but his shooting was so terrible. The Blazers were daring him to shoot. They wanted him to shoot. They were telling each other, let him shoot. They were sagging off. I mean, that's an insult and an amazing strategy and a winning strategy. So you can leave aside the whole next question theme that got so much attention in the playoffs. That's a terrible look. But it's not out of character for Russ. He's always been like that. That's nothing new. What is new is this notion that the next question might be, what do you do with Russ? And maybe even worse, what is Russ? Like, he's a hell of a player, don't get me wrong, but he was supposed to carry that team when KD left. But he hasn't carried them anywhere at all. He has another superstar and a Hall of Famer next to him, and they've still been bounced in the first round in two straight years. And each year, he's gotten caught up in a personal rivalry, and he's lost. In the playoffs, star players have to play like stars. Damian Lillard did. Russell Westbrook did not. And once again, who's going to take the fall for that? That was an implosion. Who takes the fall? Is it Russ? Or maybe, is it the Munster kid? Is it the Munster kid's fault? Is it not the Munster kid's fault? Does it even matter whose fault it is? Is it going to cost the Munster kid his job? How much of this is on Eddie Munster? How much of it's on Russ? And if ownership does tell the Munster kid to hit the bricks and take his ass back to Mockingbird Lane, where does that leave him? Does he get another sniff in the association? Or are he, Herm, Uncle Fester, Morticia, Lurch, Wednesday, Thing, and Gomez going to drag ass all the way back to college? It's too soon to tell. Hey, Thunder fan, I've got a number, and that number's toll-free. Use it. Who's it on? Is it on the Munster kid? And is he still the right guy to coach your team? You tell me.
Call me Mr.
Bad Shot.
There you go. That really is rich. PG saying somebody else took a bad shot when he runs with Mr. Bad Shot.
Call me Mr.
Bad Shot.
Nice job, Alvin. Really well done. Host of the Crossover Podcast, SI Boxing with Chris Mannix, and Inside the Paint on SI TV. Friend of the program and a very busy guy, Chris Mannix, is back. Chris, great to have you. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How you doing?
Great, my man. Awesome. Thanks for joining us. So take me through your thoughts last night, Chris, as Damian Lillard was dribbling out the clock from about 40 feet from the basket. What were you thinking, and then what was your reaction when that shot went down?
You know, in that moment, it was kind of hard to see what Lillard was thinking because, you know, the move with Paul George defending you, a guy with five fouls who wants to be eligible for overtime, you can probably get him to back off a little bit. But, you know, Lillard to pull up from the logo like that just shows an unreal amount of confidence that he was playing with in that moment. Because if you go back and watch it, I don't know that Paul George could have played it any differently. I don't know if he could have played it any better in that moment. He contested. It was a falling away type of shot, and Lillard just made it. I mean, you know, Paul's getting a lot of grief for saying that was a bad shot after the game. Maybe the timing of those comments could have been better, but that was a bad shot. Like, that was a really bad shot. That probably is the lowest percentage shot you can take in a moment like this. Lillard just made it a great one by finishing it.
You know, I guess you can make that point. And I would have said that, Chris, that's a bad shot a few years back. But then when you see Lillard, when you see Steph Curry, but I got to admit, and I mentioned before he came on, Chris, my favorite part about him saying that's a bad shot is that he runs alongside Mr. Bad Shot. I think it's pretty rich that he said somebody else had a bad shot when he plays with Russ Westbrook. That's
my
favorite part.
Yeah, that's fair. And I saw a lot of that on social media afterwards. And Russ has got to kind of look inside himself after the season to figure out exactly what it's going to take to get him to the next level. I mean, he's past the age of 30 right now, and he looks like he's regressing, you know, as a perimeter shooter. And shooting's one of those skills, Jim, that I'm convinced, and a lot of personal trainers and coaches are convinced that you can learn it. Like, if you commit a certain amount of time and effort to becoming a great shooter, you can become a great shooter. And at this stage of his career, Russell Westbrook, you know, like Rajon Rondo and, you know, to a degree like Ben Simmons early in his career, just seems okay with being who he is. And who he is an incredible talent, but as we've seen these last three postseasons, really the last two in particular, that talent is not enough to get his team out of the first round. And this was one of those series where if you can only win one game in a series like this, you've got to really reflect, because they had the team that they wanted, they had the opponent that they wanted, and they still weren't able to do anything in this series. That has to be incredibly disheartening if you're part of the Oklahoma City franchise.
Oh, no doubt whatsoever. Chris Mannix joining us. So to your point, you can change, but you have to wonder about Russ. Is Russ going to change? As an example, when he signed his extension with OKC and then Paul George didn't even look elsewhere last summer, it seemed, Chris, like OKC was in a great spot going forward. Are they still in a great spot going forward?
I think they're in a spot where they are a team with a ceiling, and it's a pretty low ceiling, because you were able to give them something of a mulligan this last year, because the Carmelo stuff was an issue for that team, the Paul George free agency, bring all these guys together. I didn't beat them up too bad after they lost to Utah in that first round. But this year, I mean, everything that could have been going for them was going for them. I mean, they had a second full season with George and Westbrook together. Westbrook, for most of the time, was playing like an MVP for most of the season. They had Dennis Schroeder come in, who was a steal for them in the past in the last offseason, getting him via trade. They had what they needed to compete. And now, if you look at that bench, I mean, you could say that Terrence Ferguson will improve. I thought Jeremy Grant was great in this series. I mean, he had to battle with some bigger guys out there, so he might get a little bit better. But there's not that blue-chip guy on the roster that you can see ascending into a higher place that's going to make them a significantly better team. So I don't know what Sam Presti and that front office, what their first move is, because you've got these guys under contract for at least the next two seasons, but what are those next two seasons going to yield? What kind of team are you? That to me is a very big question.
Chris Mannix joining us. And then back to Portland for a minute, Chris. It was not that long ago that they had a 10-game playoff losing streak, so it's pretty clear things can change quickly, and you don't need to necessarily do something major to change what happens in the postseason. So what does this series say about where they are right now, and Damian Lillard in particular, especially given the fact that Nurk went down?
Well, it says, first and foremost, they're an incredibly resilient bunch, but we knew that because of how they rebounded from last year's postseason. I mean, last year's loss wasn't exactly, you know, Spurs Heat in, 2012, where they lost a series that they were convinced they were going to win, but it was bad. And there was a lot of temptation, I think, and I know, from Neil Olshey, the GM, to clean house, to fire Terry Stotts, to trade C.J. McCollum, maybe even pursue trading Damian Lillard. If you're Damian Lillard, maybe some thought about asking for a trade and going to a different situation. I know the Lakers were lurking around Damian Lillard at the end of last season, but they, you know, they did what a good team should do. Know that they had a really good roster. Know that they had that internal improvement that I'm talking about that Oklahoma City doesn't have in Yusuf Nurkic, who was a young guy continuing to improve, and they did that. Now, Nurkic going down just shows the incredible talent of that backcourt. I mean, Lillard gets all the credit and deserves for Game 5, but how about C.J. McCollum in Game 4? What he did offensively and defensively, making play after play. I'm just really impressed, Jim, with the patience that front office showed when I think a handful of other teams out there, knowing what that Blazers team has gone through, seeing that maybe they had something of a ceiling, they might have pressed the reset button. They didn't in Portland, and we're seeing the results of it now.
Agreed. I can't say enough about the front office or the coaching staff, and they stayed the course, and now look at it. Chris Mannix joining us. All right, Chris, shifting to the East for a moment. The Bucks and the Celtics handle their business, which means we get a rematch of last year's first round. Question being, how different are the Bucks from last year to this year?
Well, I mean, they're significantly different in terms of their roster, the floor spacers they added to that team, Brooke Lopez, Ersan Ilyasova. These guys have changed the dynamic, and most importantly, in terms of what's new, Mike Budenholzer's there, and Budenholzer has completely mixed that team up and made them a significantly play to the strengths of that team. So they're markedly better. The question I have with the Bucks is something that I heard from a lot of people around the league during the season, was that this was a team that was really built to play in the regular season, maybe not so much in the postseason. That there were some questions about would these non-Giannis guys, and I'm talking about Middleton and Bledsoe and Brook Lopez, guys that either don't have a long history in the playoffs or don't have very successful history in the playoffs, would they be able to step up when things got tough? Now, the Detroit series was not that wasn't really a series. I mean, Blake Griffin missed the first couple of games, played on one leg for the rest of it. So I don't read really anything into that, much like I don't read too much into Boston. I mean, they played a Pacers team that, without Oladipo, really is like a 10 seed in the Eastern Conference. But for the Bucks, I think we're going to see if guys like Middleton and Bledsoe and Lopez, if they have within them to play at the highest of levels. Because I look at Lopez, Jim, and Lopez plays 30, 35 minutes a game for this Milwaukee team. You know, there are not too many guys the size and kind of that lumbering style of Brook Lopez that have a lot of success in the playoffs. You know, I think Boston will go small on them. They'll challenge Brook Lopez. And I think it's going to be interesting how Milwaukee reacts to that type of challenge.
Chris Mannix joining us. All right, so what about the Celtics? How are they different now from this time last year?
Oh, I mean, they're different from this time last month. I mean, this Celtic team just evolves weekly, it seems like. And, yeah, the biggest difference is they have a closer. And they were great last year with their young guys. They played a free-flowing style. Jason Tatum stepped up. All that's kind of happening again. I mean, Jason Tatum averaged about 20 points in the first round. Jaylen Brown stepped in seamlessly, I thought, for Marcus Smart. And Kyrie closed games. The biggest edge I think the Celtics will have now that they didn't have in October, November, December is what Gordon Hayward's doing. I mean, as part of my Celtics story in the magazine last week, I wrote a lot about Gordon Hayward's evolvement from month one to now, and it really is like two different players. You know, the guy in month one couldn't cut, didn't trust himself going to the basket, couldn't bounce off guys. Remember, this is a guy that last 2 years in Utah averaged about 6 free throws per game. Now, those free throws started to tick up as he's getting more and more comfortable playing through contact. So this Celtics team is a lot different. I think it's a extremely evenly matched series. It's going to come down to somebody, not Giannis, not Kyrie, maybe not even Hayward, stepping up and making plays.
I love that matchup. Chris Mannix joining us. Before you go, Chris, Philadelphia bounced back from that game one loss to Brooklyn. They win 4 straight, including 3 blowouts. You know, if you look at Philadelphia from last season and this season, it seems like every single team that faces Philadelphia in the playoffs ends up hating them. Is it a coincidence, or is that just who Philadelphia is?
Well, I think a lot of it is Ben Simmons is not the most likable player across the league. I think that was reflected in a couple of those players' polls or whatever I've seen over the last couple of months. Joel Embiid doesn't make it easy by just saying whatever's on his mind. I mean, we love it in the media, but you know that stuff certainly resonates in the locker room. So I think it's focused primarily on those two guys. I don't think that you know Tobias Harris or Jimmy Butler even have much to do with it. Those two guys are just very polarizing figures. But they're stepping into this series, and Toronto's going to put them into a blender. I mean, the Raptors, especially on the perimeter, I mean, they have two of the best perimeter defenders in the NBA, in Kawhi, who might be the best, and Pascal Siakam, who doesn't get anywhere near enough credit for what he can do on the defensive end of the floor. And, you know, guys like Butler and Harris, they're going to have a hard time. I mean, you know, Siakam and Kawhi aren't Jared Dudley. I mean, you know, they're going to go out there and challenge them on both ends of the floor. I think this is going to be a really challenging series for Philadelphia to try to win.
All right, so Chris, before I let you go, I've got to get your thoughts on the Lakers, because in the aftermath of Magic Johnson stepping down, they had a chance to go outside the family, bring in an experienced front office person. Instead, it would appear that they're sticking with Rob Pelinka. In fact, in your mind, did they even do a search?
To my knowledge, they have not reached out to the top-tier guys on other teams. Now, I don't know if they've looked at secondary guys, but the top tier guys on that are the obvious names that we all know about, I don't believe that they have reached out for it. And in fact, they are doing this I mean, Jim, like a month ago or whenever Magic quit, if you had told me that, you know, weeks later that Kurt Rambis would be sitting in on a coaching meeting and Linda Rambis would be advising Jeannie Buss, I would have thought it was something of vaudeville. Like, I never would have believed that would have actually been a reality. I mean, this is the Lakers. They have infinite resources. They can hire basically whoever they want to hire. And if you think about it, the guys that would be at the top of anybody's list, they might be more available now than they've been in the past. If you're Sam Presti, you just went through what you went through in Oklahoma City, you could leave without saying you're abandoning that team. With Westbrook under contract, with Paul George under contract, the foundation for that team is secure. If you're Bob Myers with UCLA ties, You could say, all right, I took this team as far as I could. I got three championships out of it. Kevin Durant's probably going to go. Maybe it's time to try something else. The timing of bringing somebody else in to run that team could not be better. And you couple that with, you know, a blank check the Lakers could write, whoever that is, I just don't understand why they don't even pursue these avenues. Now, I'm not a big Rob Pelinka basher. Like, if you go through a search and decide Rob Pelinka's the guy, more power to you. I hear all this stuff about how, like, GMs don't want to deal with Rob Pelinka. I mean, give me a break. Like, if you want to do a deal with the Lakers, I don't care who's running it. You will make the phone call and have those conversations with the GM. And Rob Pelinka does have a good draft history over the last couple of years. So if he's the guy, fantastic. But not going out there and doing a national search is mind-boggling to me, especially when you're a team with the resources the Lakers have.
All right, I've got a little over a minute. Well said. You had NBA Commissioner Adam Silver on your new show, In the Paint, on SITV. What is your sense as to his biggest concern right now?
Well, I mean, there are a few concerns that he has, but he addressed it on my show, and he addressed it in the Sloan Conference, and that is the lack of kind of the ability for small market teams or low revenue teams, like I should say, to compete with the big revenue teams. Because he's found that owners and executives, sometimes they have to choose between making a profit and having a winning team. And I think Adam Silver, as this stuff moves forward and we get towards the next collective bargaining agreement, I think he'd like to find a way to make that a little bit less of an issue. You don't have to choose between winning and making money. That's why something like local TV revenue, where I don't know what the Thunder deal is, but I know the Lakers are $180 million per year. It's a stark difference there. So I think you're going to look for Adam Silver to try to find some financial changes that can level the playing field even further.
I got to tell you about one of the greatest innovations I have ever seen in clothing. In fact, it's number one, the Johnny O tweener button. Johnny O invented and patented the tweener button. What this is a hidden button between the second and third button featured on all Johnny O shirts. The tweener button is the first patented button to make sure that you're not too buttoned up or too unbuttoned. You see, this hidden button solves the age-old second button dilemma. Should you button one or should you button two? And every Johnny O shirt comes with that patented tweener button, so you're always going to look just right. It is a total game changer and a no-brainer. My man Johnny O, he's a genius now. And you can use the promo code ROME and get 20% off your first order at johnny-o.com at checkout through May 30th. Again, 20% off the regular price button-ups, which come in a range of fabrics, patterns, and styles. And shipping is free for orders over $85. That's johnny-o.com, promo code ROME, and get 20% off that first order and free shipping on orders over $85. Go to johnny-o.com for your tweener shirt at 20% off and check out the wide selection of shirts and other products ranging from polos to shorts, pants, swim, and more. Johnny-O.com. If it wasn't for Dame Dalla and that dagger he sunk from the Washington side of the Columbia River, I would have opened up the show riffing on Game 7 in San Jose. I would have started with that absolutely insane comeback in the Shark Tank last night. I mean, for nearly 50 minutes, it looked like the same old story. For 50 minutes, it seemed like the same old Sharks. 27 seasons. 21 playoff appearances, no Stanley Cups, and a whole lot of misery. No team in the NHL gets less with more. No team in hockey gets more invites to the dance with nothing to show but a solo Uber ride home. And that's it. And for 50 minutes last night, it looked like another classic shark job. Vegas was rolling. Marc-Andre Fleury was dominant. Vegas 3, San Jose nothing, blood in the water, thanks for freaking coming. And then this happened.
It's just a war zone down in front of him. Down goes one of the Sharks and staying down. Is that Pavelski?
Oh my, that's Pavelski, he's bleeding.
And the referees are talking right now. This is one of those things. This could be a 5-minute major. Here, they got him.
The Sharks captain being attended to by head athletic trainer Ray Tufts.
They got Eakin. Here we go. It's going to be maybe four.
For now, it's four as Eakin's sent to the box. Debris starts to come out of the crowd as Cody Eakin sits for now, but he might get a major penalty and could be out of this game.
Pavelski taking the draw right there. He creeps cross-check, and then a double whammy as his head hits off the ice.
So that was sort of one of those bang-bang plays off a face-off and a really scary situation for Joe Pavelski. Now, I don't want to rush by that point, and we'll get to the call in a minute, but first and foremost, you never, ever want to see an injury like that to anybody. Nobody wants to see that. That's a really, really respected guy on the ice. Really tough guy. The captain, Joe Pavelski. He scored a goal with his face earlier in the series, and we're in Game 7, and he's out there playing. Here's how Joe Thornton described the injury after the game. Quote, "It almost made you cry. We love him so much. You never want to see a teammate get hurt like that. So you hold him as hard as you can, get him off the ice, and get him better." End quote. Here's what Thornton said in the moment when the Sharks were down 3 goals with just 10 minutes left in the season, according to Logan Couture. Quote, "You got to give credit to Jumbo. As soon as we got to the bench, he said, you guys go out and get effing 3 goals right now. When a man who's played 20 years orders you around like that, bosses you around, you've got to do what you got to do. So we got 4, end quote. So if you want to know how the Sharks would rally after their captain was carried off the ice, bleeding on the ice, you found out 6 seconds into that power play.
Here is a major opportunity now for the Sharks. They've got a 5-minute major power play. They're down 3-0, but they can keep scoring goals on the power play. They need to do it quickly. LeBanc, cross ice, Couture, shot, score!
All right, then, again, that was a 5-minute major, and we'll get to the call in a minute, but I just want to say, they did have a major opportunity. That's one. 49 seconds later, they scored again.
Behind the back pass to Erik Karlsson. He stops it, he shoots it, tip score! That's Tomas Hertl tipping the shot by Erik Karlsson. Another power play goal in the third.
All right, just like that, a 3-goal lead. It seemed hopeless. A 3-goal lead suddenly is down to 1, just like that. And then the game was tied.
Behind the back pass to Burns, cross ice play. Here's Couture, winds up, shoots, he scores! An incredible comeback for Sharks hockey, and Logan Couture is mobbed by his teammates. He skated all the way to the Sharks bench to celebrate with everybody. The Sharks have tied Game 7, 3-3.
And again, they were down 3-0 in Game 7 in their own house. And then the penalty, and then that's 2 for Logan Couture, and that's a tied freaking hockey game in Game 7. An unbelievable power play. And again, on that penalty, you can score as many times as you can. And that was 3. And then suddenly, it was 4.
LeBanc will field it on the right point and stop it. He moves into the circle. LeBanc keys up, shoots, score! Kevin LeBanc has just put the Sharks in front in Game 7 with 6:39 to play with a brilliant shot from the right wing side. This crowd is going crazy.
Total implosion. I mean, the wheels have come off this thing altogether. Vegas had a 3-0 lead. In the third, Game 7, it was all right there. It's amazing. I mean, if that game ends like that, that's one of the best Game 7s ever, except Vegas was not laying down. Not dead, can't quit. Not dead, can't quit, and the Golden Knights are a team made of freaking steel. Their turn to clutch the hell up. And with less than a minute to go and an empty net behind them, Jonathan Marchessault did this.
50 seconds to go. Right corner, it's Stone. Behind for Smith. Shot! Score! Knights tie it! 47 seconds to go! The feed from the back of the net found Jonathan Marchessault in front. 4-4 tie!
So I tweeted it last night. I'll say it again right here. The only thing better than Game 7 hockey, more Game 7 hockey. In overtime, with the Shark Tank in a freaking frenzy. 18 minutes and 19 seconds in, for once, the Sharks don't shark.
Puck came out, but Erik Karlsson intercepts. Moves across the line, lead, Barkley Goodrow gets around the defense, shoots, he scores! Barkley Goodrow is the hero for the Sharks in overtime in Game 7. The Sharks were down by 3 goals. They came back, they took the lead, and then after Vegas tied it, Barkley Goodrow is the big man on campus. Sharks win 5-4, and they win the series in 7.
Extra, extra, read all about it. You know what, that was only Goodrow's second shift of overtime, but he made it count. A legendary move on a legendary goalie to score a legendary goal to end a legendary game. Let's go back to the penalty on Cody Eakin. Vegas head coach Gerard Gallant was diplomatic postgame when asked about the explanation he got for the five-minute major. Jonathan Marchessault was not. In fact, this was a rant for the ages. This is what Marchessault had to say.
I mean, I really hope that Joe Pavelski is okay. Obviously, you never want to see something bad like that happen, but it's a joke. Call 5 minutes for that? That's, why don't you have a hockey replay or something? Change the whole outcome of the game. Like, seriously, what is that? It's so disappointing. It's like trying to get involved in the game. The game's not even close. It's 3-0. Call the 2, okay, but a 5? With something you don't even see? You just call the outcome. It's a f***ing joke. It's embarrassing. That's what it is.
What did they tell you on the ice as a team?
Oh, he says it looks pretty bad. Ferla told me it looks pretty bad. Wait, if it looks pretty bad, you clearly do not see it. It's a face-off. It's a push. When probably 50% of the face-off players, when they lose, they give a small cross-check, right? If you want to call the cross-check, call it. It's fine. Like, it's a cross-check. But seriously, like, he falls bad. It's unfortunate. He's like I'm a big fan of Joel Pavelski. Don't get me wrong. He's an awesome player. And he went down, and I really hope he's okay and he's going to come back. But that call, like, changes the whole outcome, changes the whole future of us, of the outcome of this year, and it's a joke. I mean, I would be embarrassed if I was one.
It's the second time in the series that they've seemingly guessed at a call.
Yeah, they guess. So exactly, why don't you have a video replay? Like, just help them. It's a fast game for everybody out there. It's a fast game. It's embarrassing.
Well, that's some kind of response. I mean, that is a rant for the ages. So the NHL's serious supervisor gave this comment on the hit post-game from the league. Quote, the referees called a cross-checking penalty for an infraction that caused a significant injury. In their judgment, the infraction and its result merited a major penalty. End quote. So if you think that's going to make anybody in Vegas feel better about that, good luck with that. About the only thing that would have made that explanation saltier to Vegas is if Jumbo Joe hit up Instagram and shopped himself into a photo with the ref, like Todd Gurley did after the NFC Championship game. Listen, when you have an amazing game like that, an amazing game, the last thing you want to do is talk about the referees. When you have a legendary Game 7 comeback, you want to talk about the action on the ice, not whether or not the guys in the stripes mangled the game. But this time, there really is no way around it. There's no way to get around it. So, was that a cross check to the face? It was not. It was not. Was that the right call on the ice? A 5-minute major? Debatable. Did the ref react to the hit or to the blood that was on the ice? That's the question, right? Was it a result of the hit or was it a result of the ice? The hit itself would in no way merit a 5-minute major. It was more of a push than a hit. I mean, if it's a push, is it even a penalty? But again, they would say, all right, fine. They would say 2 minutes is fine. Cross-check. But are you penalizing the hit or are you penalizing the result? Are you penalizing the cross-check or are you penalizing the blood? I can see why Vegas was so frustrated. But then again, last I checked, it was not the guys in the stripes scoring 4 goals in 4 minutes on one of the best goalies on the planet. It was the Sharks. And last I checked, Vegas still had enough in the tank to peel themselves off the ice and get that game to overtime, which was absolutely brass, but they couldn't finish. This one's tough. I'm not saying the refs cost Vegas that game. I am saying that if they don't make that call in that instant, Vegas probably wins. And if they don't make that call, frankly, I don't have an issue with it. Because again, are you penalizing the hit or are you penalizing the blood? Are you penalizing the hit or are you penalizing the result? I guess what I'm saying is this. I hate the fact that we're talking about the refs at all at the end of Game 7 that went to OT in the postseason. Brutal penalty. Brutal penalty kill. Let's be very clear about that. And now it's over. I don't want to say the refs cost a team a game. I never want to say that. But if that call is not made, Vegas probably wins that game. And if Vegas doesn't implode, they definitely win that game. It sucks, right? The whole thing sucks. JM summed it all up.
Summer starts 5 months now until game one of the regular season starts. It's awful.
First baseman Josh Bell is my guest. Josh, great to have you on. How are you?
Can't complain. How are you, Jim?
Good, man. Good. Great to have you. It's a long season. I know you dropped the tough one to Arizona last night, 2-1. When you have a game like that, Josh, how eager are you to get back to work, get that taste out of your mouth?
Oh, yeah. That's the beautiful part about this game. You know, last couple of games have been kind of rough, but, you know, get to wake up, rinse it off, you know, get an opportunity to get the win tonight.
We're talking to Josh Bell. So one of the things you've said, Josh, about this season is, quote, I'm living on the barrel. It's a great line. What do you mean by that?
You know, I feel like in this game, especially me as a corner infield guy, if I put, you know, two or three swings off the sweet spot a night, you know, I'm going to get, you know, a couple RBIs. I'm going to, you know, do what I need for the squad to get the W. So just trying to stay on the sweet spot, you know, for the most part, not alter my swing to get the ball in play. And if, you know, if I can, you know, hit a ball over 100 miles per hour, I'm probably hitting 600, 700. So just trying to stay right there.
We're talking to Josh Bell. I'm going to talk to you about your swing in a minute, but it seems like part of what that means when you talk about living on the barrel is you're going to rake with runners in scoring position. So how much pride is there in the way things are going right now in the sense that everybody knows that if they get on in front of you, there's a real good chance you're going to bring them in?
No, it's great. You know, it's fun baseball, especially with our pitching staff. Yeah, we got five guys that, you know, can keep guys below three, four runs a night. So if we're scoring more than three, four runs, we have an opportunity to win every night. So for me, being a cleanup guy, just trying to come out every night. There's a runner on third with less than two outs. You know, I'm doing my best to get the ball in the air, get the ball in the outfield, get a sac fly, or maybe a little bit more than that. So that's my game plan.
Pirates first baseman Josh Bell joining us. Now, you had a kind of a challenging season last year, and when that happens, there's a couple of different ways you can go, right? You can get frustrated and quit, or you can go to work. And in early September, I know you had a conversation with Clint Hurdle. What was that conversation like, and what was your takeaway from it?
Well, Clint basically sat me down and said, look, I believe in you. We want you to be our cleanup guy for years. But you kind of have to look yourself in the mirror and realize what the team needs of you and be prepared to bring that to the ballpark every night. You know, I was a guy that wasn't living on the barrel. I was a guy that was altering my swing to make contact in certain situations where, you know, swings and misses are okay in this game. It's being able to do damage. So he asked that of me, and, you know, I got to work this off season to try to really perfect that. You know, decent start so far. Rough skid the last probably 10 or so games, but really excited, like I said, to have another opportunity tonight to come out and help the boys get a W.
That's such a great line, Josh. I can't wait to tell that to my son. I've got a 14-year-old son who said something. His hitting coach hit him with the exact same thing. Swings and misses are okay. It's having to do damage, which is the big thing. I love that. I can't wait to run that back to my kid. Now, Clint.
Oh, yeah. You got to get your A swing off in this game. You look at guys that, you know, do damage. You look at the Aaron Judges. You look at the J.D. Martinez. They're going to strike out over 100 times. I mean, they're – you can't fight that. You can't, you know, alter your swing as a power guy just trying to put the ball in play because, you know, me at 245, you know, I'm not going to beat out a ground ball. The guys are too good at this level. So I'm just trying to do my best to get four balls off the barrel. And if I do that, I'm much more likely to get a hit than, you know, choking up and putting a ball in play.
That's not what you're paid to do, my man. Josh Bell joining us. That is so good. So at one point you came out here to California and you worked out. But as you told The Athletic, I went out to California to further the idea that my voice is the most important thing. Again, I find that really interesting. What did you mean by that, and how did you go about doing that?
Well, I feel like, you know, one of my things, I'm like a cerebral guy. I love hearing different concepts from different people. You know, one of those guys that has no problem reading different articles of what things are working for different guys across the league. And I got to a point to where my dad would say I was being too coachable. I was listening a little bit too much and listening to the voices that weren't the most important one, which is my own. So for me to go out to California and live on my own pretty much for the first time in my life and, you know, work out the way I needed to. And I got introduced to a new hitting coach and Joe DeMarco works with me and like Austin Hedges, and he was Matt Chapman's guy growing up. So, you know, new guy, new philosophy, and, You know, for the most part, I kind of ran my work day. He introduced things, and if I didn't like it, I had no problem saying that that's not for me. It wasn't like, you know, he was a part of an organization that was, you know, paying my bills, so I have to say yes in certain situations. It was nice to kind of unplug and get my swing off and work on myself and show up to spring training ready to go with a clear focus instead of a clouded mind.
Josh Bell, first baseman for the Pirates, joining us. Josh, you did a video with the team where you talked about the fact that baseball is a game of failure, but you can use that failure to look in the mirror and say, who do you want to be? It's a pretty profound statement, actually, not just about baseball, but about life. Like, so where did that approach come from?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you're going to fail. I mean, you've heard it 1,000 times. If you fail 7 out of 10 times, you're going to the Hall of Fame. It's how you deal with the failure. It's, you know, it's being able to rinse off bad games, bad stretches, and bouncing back with a clear mind instead of letting that doubt seep in. Because this game's so fast, any doubt, any anxiety, I feel like any game, you know, NFL, NBA, you know, golf, if you let any sense of doubt seep into your spirit, you're not going to play at your highest level, and you're not going to play for a very long time. So, you know, it's about being able to bounce back after bad stretches and realizing that you're here for a reason. You know, we're all in the big leagues because we're the best from our high school, we're the best from, you know, our college classes, and we're playing against the best, so we're going to get out. But in regards to getting my swing off and doing what I do, you know, I love the opportunity to have success, just like, you know, any pitcher loves the opportunity to get me out as well.
Josh Bell joining us. So I mentioned my son, which brings me to you and your dad, Ernest. You and your father, Ernest, spent hours working on your game. And people might think, and you know how this is, right? Like sometimes when you're working with your old man, if your old man's really hard, really tough, it's not always the best time ever. But you've always said, man, it was great. I got to hang out with Pops. It was always in good spirits. What were those sessions like? And how much did you just like playing ball and hanging out with your dad?
I think it's a thick line between, you know, overcoaching and being that dad that's yelling at your kid from the stands, you know, to get your back elbow up or come on, son. Like, you know, we've all been on teams where there's that one parent that cares, but cares in the wrong way. And my dad was always the one that, and you know, he would push me up into that point. You know, he would let me, I had the pitching machine in the backyard and those wiffle balls, so I could pretty much smoke balls wherever I wanted. If they bounced off the house like a window, nothing would shatter, nothing would break. So he would let me have my home run derby, and then he'd move the pitching machine up closer and challenge me. He'd move the pitching machine up even closer. And it got to a point to where I would go 3-for-10 instead of going 10-for-10, and I embraced that challenge. He'd be like, bases loaded, bottom of the ninth, you know, I'm fifth, sixth grade preparing. He's like, oh, you know, Saturday night game and, you know, the ballpark in Arlington. You know, it's one of those things that kind of gives me chills knowing that I'm going back next week. And that was a stadium that my dad, you know, kind of implemented in my mind. You know, you're facing the Yankees right now. You know, it's Rivero trying to get you out. You know, what are you going to do? Two strikes, what are you going to do? It's a situation where I look across the clubhouse and I see, you know, players with their sons, you know, running around, you know, playing catch, you know, having BP after our batting practice. And, you know, it's definitely special knowing that my dad's watching every at bat. You know, he's a guy that I can call after a good game, I can call after a bad game, and it's always the same message. Like, you got this. You're here for a reason. We've already trained. We've taken thousands more swings than anybody else. Like, it's just a matter of time. And it's cool to have him in my corner.
Talking to Josh Bell, I want to add one more layer to that. You go back to 2017, your father and his father went on the annual dad's road trip to Atlanta, saw you have an RBI double. What did it mean to you to have that moment with your dad and your grandfather there?
That was awesome. My grandfather hasn't seen me play since high school. And I was facing R.A. Dickey, and I'm not lying. I hit that double off the label. It was one of the nastiest knuckleballs I've ever seen. It was like right down the middle, but it moved. It seemed like 6 inches the last, you know, 3 feet in front of the plate. And I just dumped it into left field. And, you know, just being able to hear their voices from the stands, you know, it still gives me chills to think about. And it's just a testament to, you know, you know, fathers in the community. I feel like baseball is a father-son relationship. And, you know, I still got pictures from my grandfather teaching me how to play catch. You know, my dad played football, but my grandfather was a baseball guy. So he taught me to play catch in my backyard and kind of skipped a generation there, but my dad kept it going. And it's awesome to know that I've got his support as well.
Just wrapping baseball with Josh Bell for a couple of more moments. Before I let you go, Josh, I got to ask you, you crushed a home run on Sunday wearing the throwback unis, which was an amazing look, and there's some incredible history behind that. How much do you like the throwbacks?
You know, we take a lot of negative backlash. Everyone says that they don't look that good. I think they're awesome.
I like them.
Just remembering the history. We got, you know, Dave Parker shout out. We have the if you hear any noise, it's me and the boys bopping shirts. And just knowing the history, knowing what kind of atmosphere to play at that level at that time was, and to bring home world championships at that time, it must have been an amazing experience. So just to pay our regards, pay our respects, and to win in those jerseys on Sundays, it's pretty special.
Josh, I'm old enough, man. Dave Parker was electric. And this guy was unbelievable. He was amazing. Listen, last thought. Pittsburgh is a great, great sports town. What's it like to play there and represent that city?
Unreal. You know, I grew up in Dallas, and you got the Mavericks downtown. You got the Stars downtown. And then, like, the Rangers and the Cowboys are, you know, 35, 40 minutes away. So being here in Pittsburgh, knowing that all three stadiums are a couple miles apart, knowing that we're all the same colors, people bleed black and gold here in Pittsburgh, and if you don't, you're probably getting trash talked to you on the streets, in the stadiums. Just to have that support, going to Penguins games and listening to that place light up, following the Penguins the last few years, definitely special. And, you know, just knowing that, you know, a couple blocks away from our stadium, you can go to Jerome Bettis's restaurant. And when I first signed, that was the first restaurant that I went to, and they, like, took me into his, like, owner's suite, and there's, like, Lazy Boys brought out, and, like, there's, like, six flat-screen TVs in there, and it's just, like, for him and his special friends. And for me, my first experience in Pittsburgh is, you know, sitting down and, you know, a Hall of Famer's Lazy Boy. Like, this is the spot where I want to be, and sort of the spot where I want to be for years to come.
Sounds amazing. First baseman for the Pittsburgh Pirates, 61st pick overall in 2011. Pirates only a game out of first in the Central. They're at home against Arizona. Josh, my man, you crushed that. That was so fun. Really good to have you on the show. We got to be sure and do that again soon.
Awesome. Sounds good. Hopefully more to come. Cross your fingers for us.
Good night now!